Hello, this is Mike.
And Dan.
And we're coming at you with our podcast, Comparing Apples to Oranges. Dan, do you remember the concept of the podcast?
I think so. It's been a while, but I think I can trudge my way through it.
Okay.
So the general idea of the podcast...
Episode 3, if you're keeping track.
And the general idea is to take two things, either movies or albums... or something in pop culture that have something in common, but you would not normally think of them in the same context. That's where the apples to oranges thing comes in.
Because they're both fruit. But that's why they're the same.
Totally different tastes, totally right. Different textures. One is more sweet, one's more sour.
They say that about us.
And yeah, absolutely. I'm the sweet one. That's what everybody says.
And I'm the sassy one.
Right.
The sassy orange.
But it's an interesting concept because we take two things that you wouldn't normally think about. We compare them together based on a list of predetermined criteria, and then we decide a winner at the end. I think the inspiration from this came from a NPR segment that you had heard.
I'm pretty proud of you. That was better than I was going to say. I was just going to stumble through. But that was really, yeah, that's exactly right.
Well, thank you. That's why I'm the sweet one.
Yeah, and I'm the sassy one. So far, every time I've gone into it, before we actually do the criteria part, I don't pick a winner in my head, but I go in, I'm like, this is what's going to win. And then when we get to the criteria, I'm like, that's why we have that, is right. So that we don't go in with a clear bias. And, you know, we talk more about it and we figure some stuff out. So it's kind of fun.
Yeah, breaking it down, I think, gives you a different perspective of it rather than just kind of judging an overall winner, quote unquote. Breaking it down, kind of like when in my other journeys, I cover mixed martial arts, and mm-hmm. you kind of get to the end of a fight and you think, well, that guy won. But then when you go back and you look at it round by round, you might get a different opinion of it. I think you can do the same thing with what we're doing here.
And so I'm a layman to MMA. I just assume whoever got destroyed would be the loser. But apparently there's rules and stuff, people with whistles. It's a whole other world to me. All right, so today our subject that we're looking at is single artist soundtracks. All of their songs are selected for a soundtrack to a movie. We've chosen movie, but there's, you know, soundtracks to video games, TV shows, TV seasons, series, all that stuff. Apparently there was also one when we were looking this up for soundtracks to books. We've chosen two movies from the 80s. I've heard a lot of soundtracks that I've liked, and none jumped to my head until I really started thinking about this, but there's a lot to be said about a well-picked soundtrack. Are there anything that jumps to mind when you're like, you know what, I remember that song playing, mm-hmm. and I remember that scene better, and it stuck with me better, or it enhanced that experience?
You know, when in my teenage years, when I first started buying CDs and things like that, mm-hmm. I did buy a lot of soundtracks because a lot of times they were almost kind of like greatest hits albums.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Various artists. Right.
But you could get every song would be, you know, something that had been specifically handpicked from an artist in order to appear on a soundtrack. So most of the times in a soundtrack, you wouldn't have very many lame songs on right. the album. That's something that kind of appealed to me. But then you get these actual albums where they're not only associated with the movie, but they actually enhance the movie. For example, Saturday Night Fever, where
Bee Gees?
A lot of it was the Bee Gees, and we couldn't pick that into our criteria for this mm-hmm. because while they did the majority of the album, they didn't do the entire album. Right. There was some other 70s and disco acts on there, but that movie doesn't work
right.
without the soundtrack. That opening scene where you just see John Travolta's feet walking right. down the street and staying alive to the beat of Staying Alive.
That movie
doesn't work
right.
without the soundtrack. So sometimes the soundtrack is kind of just there,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes the soundtrack really enhances the movie. A recent one, Guardians of the Galaxy,
yeah.
which is my favorite comic book movie of all time. That movie would work without the soundtrack, but I don't think it would be as endearing without the soundtrack, and it's a lot of, you know, a lot of songs on there from the 70s and 80s that you wouldn't think that would really appeal to you, but in the context of the movie, it really enhanced the experience.
And I want to, you know, sort of delve into that a little bit more. It did something that you see in movies sometimes where the characters are listening to the music, and, you know, there was a lot in that movie with, like, the mixtape was so important to Star-Lord, the main character, that it sort of endeared the music to us a little bit more because it was so important to him. Plus, like, you know, it was, the music itself had some nostalgia value. It was very upbeat. It was funny at times. You know, it fit the scene well. That's an example of a movie that really did it great. I bring this up a lot where I talk about the TV show Eastbound and Down, which was, like, you know, Danny McBride comedy HBO series, which is just complete nonsense. But that show used a soundtrack better than any show I've ever seen. And I've, like, I distinctly remember shows like Sons of Anarchy. They do great, you know, they have artists come in and do covers, you know, they write their original songs and stuff. But that, like, that comedy show with Danny McBride that's like 30 minutes, like, there's scenes, it's not even that dramatic. It's just like, wow, they really nailed that with this, like, song. And you go out and you search for it.
And I think the on the opposite side of that spectrum, I watch a lot of the superhero shows on CW. I started with Smallville about, you know, 10 or 12 years ago.
I think everybody watched that when it came out.
But that kind of started this trend of not only the superhero shows, but the other shows on that network, where it's become less of the music enhancing the product, where more so where the music is just placed in the product in order to get some free publicity.
Man, that dates back to like Dawson Creek years, right, and like Charmed, right, when they're like, hey, tonight's, you know, show
featured music from there, and you can download it from this website, and I think that's I mean, those were on the WB, which eventually became the CW, so I guess it goes back even further than what but that's just the first one I remembered, is that they would place these songs in there, and sometimes the artists would even show up on the show,
right,
and that's, and it was just really a cheap placement, like somebody knew somebody who was a friend, or maybe it was for example, one of the albums we're going to talk about, the movie was produced by the same, and the artist was under contract with the music division,
they said
the
it was
same
like
corporation that made, like, the movie.
What are the term they used? I'm gonna find it. Stablemate. I'm like, oh, don't you, it makes them sound like chattel. Don't do that.
So sometimes it can work the opposite way, where it's just, why is this song is not enhancing the experience. It's just in here for almost like product placement. Almost like having a Pepsi can on the shelf in the background, you know, just to raise awareness of a product, or in this case, an artist or a song.
So that's a good example. Another good example of a terrible use of soundtrack is, do you remember the movie Rat Race from like the early 2000s?
Is it Cuba Gooding Jr. and
Mr. Bean, a bunch Rowan of, Atkinson? Yeah. And this is when Seth Green was on top of the world. So that movie, I rewatched it, and I don't remember why I liked it at the time, but now I know for a fact that it's just terrible. The movie literally culminates with a Smash Mouth concert.
Spoiler alert.
Don't see it. I just saved you're not getting spoiled. That's what the term spoiler alert should mean. Like,
a friend of mine, actually two friends of mine who were sharing an apartment together when I was in college, I guess when they moved in together, they combined their DVD collections onto one shelf.
That's like a marriage. You gotta be careful with that.
But at one point, I remember going to their apartment, and there was three copies of Rat Race on the DVD shelf.
What was one in, like, Blu-ray or director's cut?
No, this was before Blu-ray.
Okay.
So somebody had Rat Race, and somebody had two copies of Rat Race.
What if one guy had three?
And there was three in the house, and that's three more than anybody should have in their house. So
it was one of the first movies I watched on, I don't remember if it was Netflix or Amazon Prime, like, but then got really disillusioned with streaming services. I'm like, wait, are all the movies going to be this bad if I watch it on? Is that all the old movies that I thought were going to be good? I rewatch them, and I find out that I hate them. So I got really nervous at that point.
But you like the soundtrack, though.
No, I hate Smash Mouth as the worst. I think it was, that's what it was. And then another thing about soundtracks, their artists, and we're going to get into this as one of our criteria that we looked at, what movie doesn't need to necessarily have the music in the right. actual thing, but right. it's they'll call it music inspired by the film. And that was one of the first, maybe not the first, it was like within the first 25 cassettes I ever owned were like songs inspired by the movie Mortal Kombat. I just remember, like, I would listen to that cassette. And I'm like, wow, I feel like, you know, it's really bringing me back to old Johnny Cage and gotta fight Goro. So, like, everybody's in trouble.
If anybody actually downloads this and they listen to just the intro part here, where we've referenced such classics as Rat Race,
yeah.
and the soundtrack of movie inspired by the film Mortal Kombat with the great Christopher Lambert.
He's Raiden.
And we're just going to turn it off. I wonder how many, if we can track how many people tune out at the 12:31 mark, and if we get any kind of bonus points for that.
I don't know.
Stay tuned. It gets better.
Podomatic.
The music gets better.
They said I'd have to, like, pay the pro rate to, like, get those kind of data stats, so we're going to stay with the regular rate, so that's not going to happen. We're looking at single artist soundtracks. That's our concept that we're looking at today. And the two we've picked, Maximum Overdrive is AC/DC. It's an all AC/DC album. Mm-hmm. And then Batman, the original Batman from 1989, directed by Tim Burton, with Michael Keaton. And that album is completely performed by Prince. R.I.P. Prince.
Right.
So Dan and I definitely didn't pick this because of all that's happened. So this is going to come out like June 1st. This podcast is going to come out June 1st. So it's going to look like we're a bunch of like disgusting vultures. We're jumping on the
Prince bandwagon.
Really, we're just prophets of doom, which, I mean, I don't know how I feel about that.
That's happened quite a bit. Yeah. I think we're dealing with forces we don't understand.
We're only going to do true pop stuff now because those people are invincible and we can't touch them. So after this round, we're gonna play it safe for a while.
We're going to do a Donald Trump.
Or we're only going to do people who are already dead.
We're going to do people that we would...
We're going to compare...
Wouldn't affect us either.
You know, Socrates and Aristotle.
Right.
Those are apples and oranges.
We had discussed doing this podcast...
At least, like, one full week before this news came out.
And we actually had this idea when we did last podcast.
This is one of the first ones we talked about.
But we picked the artist. I'm a big AC/DC fan, but not to the level that you are.
And I like Prince, but not as much as
exactly.
you.
Exactly. And, you know, Prince had always, with my family, my older sister and my three younger brothers, we were huge Prince fans.
Princelings?
Just growing up.
What do they
up.
Call that fan base?
We'll take it.
Okay.
Whatever it was, we'll take it, because I know a lot of people were more inspired in the 80s by Michael Jackson's music, and I was a big Michael Jackson fan, but I always kind of gravitated more to Prince. Not that you have to like one or the other. And we had decided that these are going to be the two we're going to compare about a week ago, and then we found out, I guess it was about 48 hours ago, that Prince had passed away. And just the night before, I had... Right. spent about 2 hours listening to not only the Batman soundtrack, but also doing research on the genesis of that soundtrack coming together. Because I had known a lot about it when it actually came out, just because I was such a big superhero fan.
Right,
and that's
of course.
How I kind of gravitated toward the soundtrack. The fact that we found out this news the very next day.
Right.
I mean, we actually... we're making comparisons off air on Wednesday night, I think, and then on Thursday we got the news, and here we are on a Saturday recording. So totally not jumping on the news bandwagon to try to get more hits or more downloads or anything. This is something we already had planned.
We're not going to put it in the hashtag either.
Right.
I don't think that's
cool. Right, and it's kind of a somber thing to talk about,
right.
you know, 48 hours after his passing, but... It can kind of be, you know, a tribute as well.
AC/DC was in the news this week also because their lead singer, Brian Johnson, he had to formally step down because of his degenerative hearing loss got so bad that they said this is Hollywood, they said, if you do one more concert, you will be functionally deaf.
Mm-hmm.
So he had to step down and Axl Rose took his spot, and that was announced this week.
Before we delve into it, I wanted to ask you an AC/DC question, since you're kind of the guy that, like I said, I'm a big fan, but not to the level that you are.
Okay.
Is there a division in the fans between the Bon Scott years and the Brian Johnson years, or are there, is there a group that doesn't care either one? Because I know with Van Halen, mm-hmm. there are some people that are just Van Halen fans and they right. like anything, everything that Van Halen puts out.
Right.
And then there's some people that are so pro David Lee Roth mm-hmm. that they, that anything Sammy Hagar ever does, they're yeah. never going to listen to. Are they so pro Sammy Hagar mm-hmm. that, that the opposite is true? Is there any, is there a kind of a division there in the AC/DC
so
fan
I feel
group?
I'm going to answer this as diplomatically as possible for a couple reasons. One, even though I'm a huge fan, because I came into it like in the early 2000s, I started listening to them in high school, and so I sort of jumped on. I don't think I was on the ground floor at that point, so I don't consider like my view the view of all AC/DC fans, but I'm going to answer this this way. So there is, they literally call them like the Bon Scott era and the Brian Johnson era because they are different to people who like them, and I like them a lot. And I, if you played two songs, I'd be able to identify mm-hmm. who's singing. So I like Bon Scott more, mm-hmm. and that's where I'm coming at from me being a fan. And I like Brian Johnson's, most of his songs, and I like how he sings and he, how he performs and how the band sounds with him. I don't only listen to Bon Scott songs. Like, I love all AC/DC. I love Bon Scott stuff more. But I think one thing that doesn't cause any bad blood in the same way that the Hagar and David Lee Roth stuff is that, like, Bon Scott died like unbelievably tragically while he was really young, while the band was still young, and like Brian Johnson didn't really wrestle the reins away from anything as so much like they put this upon him. They said, hey, will you join us? And right. he stepped up and he was his own person. I've heard a lot of people complain, they're just like, I, the guy died and the joke is that he came back, like, so they just put somebody in who sounded the exact same. So that's where I'm coming at. Yes, I think there's a difference. Yes, I like Bon Scott more, but Brian Johnson did a really good job. And the band, the energy was similar, but Bon Scott's was just more crazy and fun and like playful, where mm-hmm. Brian Johnson was sort of just like, he kept it heavy, you know, he was like a bad, you know, he was a bad boy,
very
sort
intense,
of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, kind of in your face.
Right.
Yeah.
But if you look back, Bon Scott era, a little sillier, a little more in your face, like mm-hmm. dirty deeds done dirt cheap, mm-hmm. like that's funny, you know.
Yeah.
And then like the whole thing with like Black Ice, you're like, oh, it's cool, we're only releasing it at Walmart. You're like, mm-hmm. I don't think Bon Scott would have done that,
right?
And then I listened to the album, I'm like, this is still pretty good. Like mm-hmm. every time you hear somebody talk, I talk trash on, oh, Kansas, they're still touring, like I don't think that's cool, but I haven't listened to them, so maybe they are still good. Mm-hmm. You know, so now we're going to discuss the four criteria we've decided that makes a great single artist soundtrack for a movie. Number one, we use this criteria a lot, re-listenability. Do you want to listen to this album more than once? Does listening to it more than once make you appreciate it more? Do you want to go back? Do you want to listen to this track again? Going along with that, we would talk about, does this album stand up on its own? Would you listen to this album even if you didn't see the movie? I think this is an interesting one because you don't really consider this with most albums. You might consider it with like a sequel to a movie, like, is this a good standalone movie on its own? I think for a soundtrack, do you want to share this with people? Would you listen to it in your car while you're doing chores or something? When you go back, you're like, you know what song is really good? The song off of the Daredevil soundtrack. I think that was like the first, one of the first soundtracks I bought because it had like Evanescence. It was inspired by the movie and it, you can only get it off of the Daredevil soundtrack. And I'm like, you know what? I want to, you know, that's pretty strong. Like, even though they're singing about Daredevil, it's like, this is a cool album.
Yeah. If they didn't have any kind of association with the movie at all, would it still be a good album?
Criteria number three, we talked about creative inspirations. We had difficulty fully articulating what we wanted this criteria to sound like, even though we both agreed that it's really important for an album to have this. So, Dan, do you want to go over what we tried to talk about for this?
Sure.
Creative inspiration.
I'll do my best.
Okay.
I think we were talking about the difference between a soundtrack that is written with the movie in mind,
okay,
rather than just a soundtrack that is put together to help promote a movie.
Right.
So did the creators of the soundtrack write the songs and perform the songs with that tone and those thoughts in mind? Or were the songs not necessarily already recorded, but were they just standards from that group or band that were thrown together to be part of more of a promotional part of an album. We talked about that a little bit with the TV shows too. Right. Were they actually written with the TV shows in mind, or were they just used hand in hand with the TV show? So I think that's what we were trying to shoot for with that category here.
And I don't want to belabor this, but I want to consider like cherry picking songs as necessarily a bad idea, because you always want, why would you pick this? You're like, because I think this is one of their best songs, but I think this one is appropriate for the feelings of, you know, this part of the movie or this character, et cetera, et cetera.
And that's one of the things that made that kind of gravitated me to soundtracks early on, was that the fact that they did certain artists, and that's what made a soundtrack so cool,
because
is they could get this many great songs on one CD or one tape or one album.
Right. It's sort of like bonus features, or it's like when the movie's over, you're getting extra information, like the story doesn't end there, or the character actually has more depth, and this, you know, this song's going to evoke a little bit more just out of its listener. And I think that's really cool. And then our last criteria, was the soundtrack used in the movie? Was it used effectively in the movie?
But if it was used in the movie, was it just thrown in there for background, or was it put in there to actually enhance moments in the movie, or to make the movie even better? We talked about Guardians of the Galaxy that would work without that soundtrack. The songs that they chose actually elicit the emotions in you that mirror what the character is going through. And I think that if a soundtrack is used effectively within the movie, if you watch the movie without the soundtrack in it, it could be a totally different movie.
Yeah.
It could be better or it could be worse.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, we're looking for, did it make the movie better? Whether certain scenes or just the movie as a whole.
This is one of Dan's favorite topics to talk about. Wes Anderson. if you watch the Royal Tenenbaums and there's a Richie Tenenbaum scene, if they played anything but, you know, Elliot Smith, that would be a different movie. Like, whether it's, that scene's very powerful, it's very depressing, it's always going to stay with you, and that song is always going to evoke that scene in my head. And Dan, one day it'll evoke that scene in your head, because I'm going to trick you into watching.
Ever makes his way in any way onto this podcast, I will not participate.
What if
I won't?
Okay, here, that's fair. What if Wes Anderson directs Guardians of the Galaxy 2?
I don't care if he's on the podcast. I'm not coming on.
I can't. Okay, that's a real threat for all of us. Not going to happen, Dan.
He would not direct Guardians of the Galaxy 2, because Guardians of the Galaxy 2 is going to be great. And Wes Anderson sucks.
Dude, just watch Fantastic Mr. Fox. It'll change your mind. Roald Dahl.
I'd rather George watch Clooney. Fantastic Four. And that movie sucks.
I think you're just trying to hurt my feelings. I don't know why you would do that.
No, Wes Anderson's feelings. And he doesn't have feelings.
No, he's got so many feelings. Oh my God. How do you not know those? Okay, anyway. So those are our four criteria. We're going to just paint a little picture for you for the two albums. Also, a little bit background knowledge on the movies. Dan and I took this pretty seriously. When he suggested soundtracks, I'm like, oh, I'll just listen to it. And I'm like, I don't think I've seen Maximum Overdrive. And then when I realized that Batman came out in 1989, I'm like, I know I haven't seen that in a long time. Dan watched both of them, and I listened to the CDs at least twice each. Uh-huh. So how did you listen to the CDs this time, Dan? For some reason, this is entertaining to me when we talk about this.
I listened to the CD first. And then I watched the movie right after.
Okay.
And then at some point in the next several days, I would listen to the CD again. Because it's easier to listen to a CD and still have other things on rather than watching a movie. And you really, you know, to be fair to the movie, you can't just be doing chores or, you know, doing things around the house and just kind of having the movie in the background.
Especially if you're paying attention to how the soundtrack is used.
Right, but you can do that with soundtracks. Right. And that's the great thing about music, is that you can be in the car and you can be cutting the grass. You could be cleaning the house. You could be walking the dogs. And you could be listening to the soundtrack. So I did soundtrack, movie, soundtrack for both of them.
Okay. So I did... fun fact about me this week, my antenna fell off my car. I don't know how.
Mm-hmm.
And so my radio doesn't work because I have a car that's old. So I burned the albums onto CDs and I would listen to them in the car. And it was like the perfect amount of time between my house and work. An interesting thing about Prince and the Batman soundtrack was that Danny Elfman Danny Elfman's the composer. Mm-hmm. He wrote the score. They talked about how they wanted the score to be released on its own album, which was really unusual. Elfman was surprised because almost nobody was doing that. So first of all the stuff Danny Elfman did is awesome. They used it on the Batman ride. They've used it in the Lego Batman video games. Mm-hmm. They used it on the animated series in 1992. It's literally part of the whole mythology behind him.
Kind of like the Superman.
Mm-hmm. Jurassic thing. Park, anything like
that. You know, that's what Batman is. Right. That's the feel, that's the tone of what Batman should be.
And Dan found some like hilarious connections between the two movies and soundtracks that we didn't expect. And so I just want to bring up the Simpsons connection, which is Yeardley Smith, who is the voice of Lisa, is one of the characters in Maximum Overdrive. Super annoying character. And then Danny Elfman, who did the score for Batman, did the score for the Simpsons song, which everybody knows. So I thought that was a cool connection.
And then there's another connection, too, with Maximum Overdrive was actually beat out to the worst films and the worst actors and the worst directors. It lost for worst director and worst film, I believe, to Under the Cherry Moon,
which I didn't see that. Did you see
it? I've never seen it either.
It doesn't sound very good.
And that was written and directed by Prince.
Right.
So Prince actually won the Golden Raspberry for worst film for Under the Cherry Moon and worst director.
Right.
Beating out Maximum Overdrive. So there's a little bit of a connection there. And then you said that gas station owner in Maximum Overdrive.
And then Commissioner Gordon.
Commissioner Gordon, the same actor plays Commissioner Gordon in the Batman movie.
Pat Hingle. I think he had one of those like connections between Tim Burton and somebody else where it was just, or he was like a big name in the 80s, I don't know, but he's like a middle-aged guy and he like plays like, he can play a grumpy guy good, so they're like, oh, well,
so a lot of things that we didn't anticipate being, you know, 6 degrees of separation.
Yeah, because they're released 3 years different. I know it sounds like we're trying to paint it on pretty obvious that they're not the same. A horror movie and, you know, action adventure Batman, like one's put out by Warner Brothers, the other's by like some no-name thing that doesn't exist, or studio that doesn't exist anymore. So it's just kind of unusual that connection would, any connection would exist, let alone three that we found. One that I stumbled on, one that was on Wikipedia, and one that's just like, you know, Simpsons knowledge, anybody would figure that out. Mm-hmm. That was kind of cool. Which one do you want to talk about first, Dan?
Let's do AC/DC, Maximum Overdrive.
Okay. So I knew that AC/DC did this album before I watched the movie or listened to the whole album because big fan of AC/DC.
Mm-hmm.
Maximum Overdrive is an adaptation of a Stephen King short story called Trucks, and it was off of his first collection of short stories called Night Shift, and it was published in 1978. Stephen King, I've read, you know, probably two dozen of his books. You know, I've read his whole, like, Dark Tower series, which is just, like, 7 books, and they're each getting longer, and so I put a lot of time in him as an author. And this man, whenever he tries to put his hands into a movie adaptation or a TV series adaptation of his work, I don't know what, he's got like the reverse Midas touch. I don't know what it is. And he actually directed Maximum Overdrive and it was atrocious. Like, as a film, I did not enjoy this.
Right. And I kind of thought that I would, based on the premise of it. In this short story, inanimate objects start coming to life and killing people.
Particularly vehicles, because he sort of, I mean, he had Cujo, his novel about like a giant dog that goes crazy. And then later, 2008 or something, he had the book Cell, because I mean, he's written a lot. And so he sort of just rehashes some of his own ideas, tropes, events, characters, which a lot of authors do that. But it's just like, it started off as a good, you know.
I mean, like you said, He's a great writer. There have been a lot of great adaptations of his work.
So Shawshank Redemption, Green Mile,
right?
Shining.
I loved It, the movie adaptation with Tim Curry as Pennywise. Mm-hmm. It's just very scary
that.
And just amazingly well done.
Right.
But even Stephen King was quoted as saying that this was the worst adaptation of his work.
He said he was going to take a break.
And there was a quote that I found that he said, "I was coked out of my mind all through its production, and I really didn't know what I was doing." And you can tell based on the final product.
It's just so...
It sounds like a dumb enough idea that I would love it.
Because it's an 80s movie, so you're like, okay, everything's going to be crazy. They were very creative with their special effects at that time. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, like, George Romero was out, you know, he was doing weird stuff. Scanners was doing weird stuff. Cronenberg was doing weird stuff. And then this movie just had a bunch of trucks exploding and like dummies full of red paint getting hit by cars. And you're like, it had potential. Because, I mean, I'm sure if I read the short story, I'd be like, oh, this is pretty good. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a good author.
Well, okay. I didn't realize that the soundtrack for this... Mm-hmm. That I actually already had it in my iPod. Because when you told me that it's the Maximum Overdrive soundtrack, it turns out that it was an AC/DC album.
Who Made Who?
Who Made Who?
Which, if you put in Maximum Overdrive soundtrack into Google or Amazon, Who Made Who is going to pop up.
Exactly. It actually doubled as an AC/DC project, but also... as the soundtrack for the film, basically just because of Stephen King's love of the band.
Which he was, I don't know if he was quoted as saying, but they put it down as, he picked it because it was his favorite band.
Right.
And it's like, okay, again, though, I'm going to get into this a little bit later, like, his choices did not seem like he likes AC/DC that much, or he knows a lot of their songs. Because the ones he picked... He picked a couple no-brainers that were awesome, but I mean, like, it just didn't seem like he knew a lot of their stuff, because there's some songs talking about, like, driving and trucks and cars, and you know, he sort of didn't pick those.
Right.
So, we'll get into that in a little bit.
It was seemed very random.
The information I got, they came up with three brand new tracks for the soundtrack, and that was Who Made Who, and then two instrumentals. Mm-hmm. Which was DT. I didn't look up what that stood for. And then Chase the Ace. And then the rest were songs off of older albums.
Right.
And mostly from the Brian Johnson era, except for Ride On, which was Bon Scott.
Right. So you got You Shook Me All Night Long.
Right.
Sink the Pink.
Right.
Hell's Bells. Shake Your Foundations. Mm-hmm. And For Those About to Rock, We Salute You.
That's parenthetical, by the
way. But like you said, all of them were Brian Johnson
songs,
with the exception of Ride On. So there was even... That even kind of struck me as a little weird, too, that not only was it all AC/DC and that they recorded some new stuff, but a lot of it was old, but they pulled from the Bon Scott era as well, which was, it seemed a little bit more random.
And then I have here five songs that were all instrumental that were used in sort of like a sound beds or background noise. Sort of stuff. And then there was a scene with, like, I don't know, it was a helicopter or a plane or something, and they were playing, like, Flight of the Valkyries. I'm like, you could have found any AC/DC song about flying, like, and just substituted better. So I'm being highly critical here because I think that's the point of this podcast. But anyway, that is Maximum Overdrive and AC/DC's single artist contribution to that album. You ready to talk about Batman?
Sure.
And Prince?
Sure. I'm always ready to talk about Prince.
All right.
Basically, this was kind of a make or break situation for Warner Brothers bringing Batman to the big screen in 1989. I was about 9 or 10 years old, but Batman had not had a big screen presence really ever. I mean, outside of the, I believe they did a full length movie version of the 1966 Adam West Batman.
I remember seeing that at Blockbuster.
But to that point, that was really the only adaptation, other than the serials that they made in the 40s, of Batman. And so when this movie came out, and even as young as I was, I remember seeing the costumes for this, and everybody's saying Batman's costume isn't black,
right?
And now that's kind of become not exactly that, but like the darker gray and black mix has
sort of the concept of it,
right?
Like, it's not going to be cartoony,
right? And that was
run away with a giant bomb.
When you bring in Tim Burton, you know you're going to get a different tone to it. There was some talk about when it first came out, and then there was announced that. Even though I was so young when this came out, I was still aware of everything that people were talking about, that Prince was basically to balance out how dark the movie was going to be, because at that point, you know, Prince was that, and that, like I said, that was the idea, but it turned out that that wasn't the case.
Really.
Prince was, you know, the big colorful outfits and colorful personality and and bright and funky sort of and
wild and unconventional.
And that, and the thought was, oh, they're bringing Prince in order to balance out how dark this movie is, because they weren't sure how this movie was going to be received.
It's really interesting.
Especially with the fact that, you know, Michael Keaton's playing Batman.
Right, and he was a comedian before this.
You know, Mr. Mom is playing Batman. And that was another thing. Nobody knew how this movie was going to turn out. There was just so many question marks. And then the fact that Prince was doing the soundtrack. But it actually turned out that Tim Burton had written Jack Nicholson's Joker character with some of Prince's former music in mind. If you listen to that music and you listen to kind of the upbeat, you know, tone and melodies of those songs, and you kind of see Jack Nicholson's portrayal of the Joker, just the over the top, just, you know, in your face, you know, goofiness, but also murderous at the same time. Elicits so many emotions there. So Tim Burton actually had Prince in mind when he was writing the Jack Nicholson Joker character, and it worked out because Prince was also under contract with Warner Brothers music.
He was the stablemate
that they used. But
pulled out of that closet.
Weird thing that kind of came out of that relationship is that they said that he would write the album for Warner Brothers with the understanding that the songs would become the property of Warner Brothers.
Oh, interesting.
And that he could perform them live, because, I mean, you can really perform anything you want live.
Right.
But the songs that were on this album could not compilations or Prince collections. So you won't hear even though there's some great songs on the Batman soundtrack,
right,
and it's a very underrated album, you won't hear those songs on any best of you know, Prince albums, unless there's some kind of agreement that comes
sponsored by Warner Brothers
later on.
Interesting.
But he was actually kind of in a weird place when this album came out, because it had been 4 years since his last number one album.
Wow.
He had actually kind of had a string of a couple, I want to say duds, but because there were some great tracks on those albums, but there was a string of 4 years, and he was putting out almost an album a year, and they were kind of disappointing based on the success that he had had before, particularly the one that came right before the Batman soundtrack, which was Love Sexy. His last number one album was Around the World in a Day, which had been in 1985. So he was kind of in a weird place and trying to reinvigorate himself. So I think he probably made that agreement with Warner Brothers, which you wouldn't think somebody like Prince would normally do.
Yeah,
but I think he saw this as an opportunity to kind of get back into the mix and kind of get back on the horse. And it worked out really well, because the album ended up going to number one. And then it really catapulted him into that whole 90s era, when he kind of got his mojo back.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he wasn't going to take any crap from the record companies anymore. He was writing Slave on his face while he was performing on TV, and he changed his name to The Symbol, and he really, like I said, got his groove back, got his mojo back, and kind of propelled him to the next stage of his career. So it's the album's kind of overlooked just based on its connection to Batman movie, but it actually had a big effect on, you know, the rest of Prince's career.
So a little bit of information about the album. It said it was recorded in 6 weeks, and they used three tracks that had already been recorded earlier. Those were Electric Chair, Scanning, and then it said that they were actually going to use 1999 and another one called Baby I'm a Star, but instead Prince just recorded fresh material. So in that context of what you just said, maybe he didn't want 1999 and Baby I'm a Star.
He didn't want any kind of relation between 1999, a song that he was his and his baby, and he didn't want that related in any way to something that Warner Brothers could sink their claws into.
Which, I mean, that makes a lot of sense now.
And actually, Vicki Vale was the love interest of Bruce Wayne in the movie.
Kim Basinger.
So,
the actress.
And, you know, you would think that, well, how could that have been written before?
Right.
It was actually originally called Anno Waiting, which was written for his girlfriend at the time on her 18th birthday, Anna Garcia,
creepy.
Who's her stage name was Anna Fantastic. And she's actually does a lot of the background singing, a lot of duets with Prince and even performed on this album. But he changed the words around a little bit and made it...
And then the last little bit of trivia I found was that they had planned... I don't know how much of this stuff can be verified, but they said they planned that Prince would do all the funky songs and they were going to try to get Michael Jackson to do all the love ballads.
Right.
And then it's quoted as, this plan was unfruitful in that Michael Jackson's not on the album.
Right.
And so...
and it probably... I mean, it could have been... It could have
been wild.
It could have been money. It could have been ego. It could have been
in the 80s,
you know, a lot of different
late
things. But who wouldn't want to have Michael Jackson and Prince, you know, working together or not even
just
working
having,
together, but just doing, you do half the soundtrack, you do half of the soundtrack.
That'd be awesome.
But I mean, that maybe that was just a pipe dream for them.
Might have just been publicity.
It was kind of interesting that fact is out there. And, you know, there's got to be some truth behind it, even if it was just a pipe dream for him. But thing that was cool about this album is that, you know, even though three of the songs had been written previously, you know, all the songs had some kind of connection. You know, the first song, The Future, you know, it talks about the bleak future that Gotham City is heading toward and kind of the dark road that it's heading down. And then the second song, which was written previously, Electric Chair, you know, it invokes the Joker's dive into increasing madness and even a ballad like Arms of Orion, which was with Sheena Easton, I believe.
That's right, yeah.
They used the Orion constellation as a metaphor for the wide arms holding two people together, even though they are or will eventually be far apart. And that ties into the Bruce Wayne Vicki Vale
romance
connection in the movie, is that they want to be together, but because of what Bruce Wayne has to do as Batman, you know that that's destined not to happen.
Right.
And they even kind of mention that in the sequel, Batman Returns. They just briefly mentioned that she couldn't handle it.
Right.
And
sort of
she
implied
had to,
in the end
she
of
had
the
to go away.
End of the movie too.
Right.
When Alfred picks her up.
All the songs, I think, tie in to the film, and
I think you're getting ahead of yourself because we're not on to the criteria
on to
part.
The criteria. sorry about that.
Do you want to talk about re-listenability first?
Sure,
that's our first one we talked about.
This one was easy for me to judge because unlike the in previous shows where it was kind of hard for me to gauge the re-listenability quotient with that. But with having had both of these in my catalog, I was able to really look back. It's like, well, which one do I listen to more?
Let's look at big data.
Yeah.
Let's do some mining.
Let's get some numbers here. And the one that I listen to more and the one that I will, go back to the AC/DC, there are specific tracks on the album that, because they popped up on other albums as well, they pop up in the rotation a lot more
as single tracks.
But as an actual album, I think it would be the Batman soundtrack for me, because I will actually at times say, oh, I haven't listened to the Batman soundtrack in a while. And I don't know if that's, you know, part of that is, you know, just the connection with the film, that I found myself going back to Prince's album more actually as an entire album. Although there are tracks on the AC/DC album that I listen to quite a bit, but they're usually because I'm listening to a best of AC/DC album or something like that.
And I think that'd be pretty easy to piggyback off of, where if I heard Hell's Bells, I don't think, oh, you know what, I should listen to the rest of I wouldn't say the Maximum Overdrive soundtrack because I didn't know that. I would say, oh, I need to listen to the rest of Who Made Who. I'm like, I wouldn't say that. I'd be like, oh, I want to listen to the rest of Back in Black.
Right, exactly. And there's a lot of degrees that you have to go through there.
And I have this thing where I listen to a CD long enough, like the track order doesn't really get ingrained, but like I start to expect what's next. And like, especially if it's like, oh, you know what, I'm listening to the instrumental. I want to skip it and go to the next one. It's like, because Who Made Who is, I don't even think it's the best of. It's just sort of like they randomly threw stuff together. Right. And we're going to get to that too. But it's like, you know, I know what I'm going to expect next on Back in Black. Mm-hmm. And when I don't hear it, it's not that I get disappointed. It's just like, that's not, this isn't right. Even though I wasn't a huge fan of every song on the Batman soundtrack, mm-hmm. I liked that arrangement. I liked that how it went together. Like, I listened to that one more.
Right.
And it was, you know, because AC/DC's great, but that flow didn't work for me. So I didn't think the re-listenability was there for me, where I literally have re-listened to, like, AC/DC's albums. Like, I'll just put it in, mm-hmm. and even though it, like, rolls over, I'll listen to it two times, like, in the same sitting.
Sure.
Where I don't know if I would do that with Prince, but I know I'm not going to do it with Who Made Who.
Right.
So that one goes to Prince. Okay. Do you want to talk about, we'll mix it up, which soundtrack was used in the movie more, which one was used more effectively, mm-hmm. which one enhanced the movie watching experience?
I think it was easy for me to pick Prince on this one.
Okay.
And the reason being is that there are specific scenes in that movie, two in particular. The party man scene.
That was a good scene.
Where Jack Nicholson is just raising hell
right.
in the museum. Right. And
they're playing the song through, like, him and his goons come in.
with an old school boombox.
A ghetto blaster. Uh-huh. And
gentlemen, let's broaden our minds. Lawrence?
And then he hits the boombox. And, like, the scene in the movie, it's sort of a little kitschy because it's all these really weird gangly white men
uh-huh.
trying to dance to Prince. And, like, 80s music is historically difficult to dance to uh-huh. outside of the 80s. Like, it did not stand the test of time. But Prince is, he's a funky man.
Yeah.
And his music is not to be danced to by those men.
Right.
Especially, and they were trying, I think they were trying their best. Like, uh-huh. I genuinely thought all of those people were doing their best to dance to right. Prince. I did not think that went well. I enjoyed the song, and when I listened to it on the soundtrack, I'm like, that's really cool that they have that part in there. And it just, that seemed sort of, but you know what? Maybe because it was out of place that's what they were trying to get to, because the Joker is like, so, Joker isn't funny, Joker isn't serious, he's crazy.
Right, he's crazy. And that scene, I don't know if it would work with another song. I mean, it made the scenes so perfect.
Yeah.
And he even goes to the painting that is just, you know, darkened, you right. know, desperate, and he saves that one from right. being destroyed. He's right. like, I kind of like this one. Right. Let's leave it. And then the other scene was
the parade scene.
The parade scene where Trust is played.
Right. You be here with me.
And Jack Nicholson even, you know, plays up the song title there,
mm-hmm.
where he says, "Who do you trust? Hubba right. hubba hubba, money money money. Who do you trust? And where's the Batman?" So the outrageousness of that scene, and you know, throwing them, it yeah. tied in so well with that song. Those two scenes, I think, were enhanced so much that they've kind of become iconic, mm-hmm. at least in comic book movies. Just based on the presence of Prince's music mm-hmm. in those scenes.
So after you said all that intelligent stuff, it didn't work for Prince in that there was only three songs in the movie that were off the soundtrack, mm-hmm. and it was so those two, and like it just seemed unusual to me that the only music we heard that wasn't Danny Elfman's like mm-hmm. Evocative, mysterious like score was like the Joker playing Prince mm-hmm. twice in public, mm-hmm. which was weird, and then Scandalous during the credits. Looking for tonight, why don't we skip all the foreplay, mom? Just get down here on the floor. Scandalous. I'm talking about you and me. And Scandalous did not work for me. And, like, that's just because that's not, you know, that's not my kind of music.
I think there was another one at the very beginning. I think they played The Future. You hear it on a radio.
Okay.
And I think it was
good
during,
Easter egg. I didn't catch that.
I think it was during...
Because I liked that song.
The scene. It's a very good song. And it's a great way to kick off the album, too. So you're going...
I'm going with Maximum Overdrive's use because, like...
Tell me what.
Beginning credits, they play Who Made Who. And that's literally when the machines... So after the god-awful prologue script where they're explaining a comet. And, God, that was a bad movie, Dan. I don't know. And so... Yeah, and it also takes...
Got Emilio Estevez in it.
The Mighty Ducks man himself. Yeah. The movie... Okay, I'm just... It takes place 1 year in the future, which... That intro is Who Made Who, the song that was written for the movie, and that's right when the machines start flipping out. And it's like there's an ATM that calls Stephen King an asshole, mm-hmm. and then you're already like, oh wait, this is going to be silly. And then a bunch of people die while watermelons are falling, and you're like, I don't know what to do with this, because it's like, there's clearly a lot of like production work going into these special effects, and it's like Danielle was watching the beginning of it, and she was like scared, and then like, a guy tried to get out of his car, and he slipped on a bunch of watermelons. I'm like, I don't know where I am right now, but Who Made Who came on, and it was like, you know, it was like blistering, it was really cool. And then, like, they had AC/DC playing on the jukebox a couple times, and they played Ride On, like, at a part when they're all, like, sitting together and thinking about stuff. Got myself a one-way ticket. And they go on a mission, and they're playing For Those About to Rock, We Salute You. They use Hell's Bells, and I love that song, mm-hmm. and they use it in a montage, which is how you're supposed to use it, but they just, God, it's a dumb scene, and I don't know how I felt about that. And then the credits, they had Shook Me All Night Long. And I'm like, okay, that's cool. You know, like, so it's like the use of the album and the songs that were picked by Stephen King, I thought did a good job to enhance this god-awful movie. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
It does. And I think just to play devil's advocate
naturally
to that, I just saw it as we're just going to throw a bunch of AC/DC stuff in here because mm-hmm. AC/DC is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And they are.
Yeah.
But just to kind of, you know, show how badass and,
right.
you know, how hardcore this
right.
this movie is or the right. concept.
Because the joke is. Was, like, the mission that they went on, they ended up doing, like, they were going to go save a, like, pick up a guy who was dying. And then when we got there, the guy was dead, but they found a kid. I'm like, great mission, guys. Like,
right.
you can do what you're not about to rock. I don't salute you. And that was the thing is, like, the best part about those scenes were the songs that I liked. Does that make sense?
Right.
Like, that enhanced the movie.
Because
if they would have played, you know, Foreigner, you know what? I like Double Vision, but it's not making this one coming at.
Took a terrible movie and made it less terrible for you.
I don't even know what go about that far. But the Prince had an unfair advantage because Danny Elfman's had, like, oh, there's the Batman theme. Like, so every time there was an important thing, they're like, we're going to do the score. You know, that somebody composed about Batman. They didn't play Bat Dance when Batman, you know, arrived to save the day. And I think that just put the album, the soundtrack, rather, at a disadvantage.
Well, let's just say that Prince kind of has an advantage over all mortal
That's fair.
Human beings. So
right. All right. Next one. Let's talk about standalone album.
Okay. I picked... AC/DC
okay.
for this one. And I think the reason why is kind of what we talked about earlier is the fact that there's so many very good hard rock, metal,
mm-hmm.
individual tracks
mm-hmm.
on this album with, you know, with You Shook Me All Night Long and Hell's Bell. There's just so many excellent standalone songs
mm-hmm.
on there, even though they were picked and choose from different eras of the band and weren't necessarily created for specifically for the movie, with the exception of Who Made Who,
mm-hmm.
which is another very good song.
Yeah,
you know,
it was one of their like top selling singles because
of
this.
That starts off the album too, and it's mm-hmm. and it's also a very good song. So I think for standalone, I picked the Maximum Overdrive soundtrack.
Okay, I definitely picked Prince on this one because
interesting.
So again, like I'm going in. Clearly, we were super biased on this one. Like we both chose somebody that we liked, and I'd never seen Maximum Overdrive, and I don't think the original Batman is your favorite Batman.
Not by
so any means, I mean we sort of went in. I was disappointed in AC/DC. I'm like, Who Made Who is not. When I read it, I'm like, oh okay, I think I know any of the songs on there besides Who Made Who, mm-hmm. and then I looked it up, and it's like, oh, I know Blow Up Your Video, but that wasn't. Like, that was their promotion. That was their, like, tour. That wasn't a song on there. I'm like, oh, I thought that was one of the songs. Nope. It's just, like, it didn't have any staying power for mm-hmm. me. You know, the flow is wrong. The tracks sort of seem clunky together. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think right as soon as you said that, it kind of put a thought in my head about standalone album versus standalone collection of songs.
Well, that's fair.
I think maybe I was kind of looking at it more as a... as the songs individually thrown together rather than as a standalone album and kind of how
and that's how you're supposed to do it. I approached it with my bias, and that's where I was like, Prince, like, I don't know his flow of album, but the way this one worked with, like, the way that Future started and then, like, Electric Chair, like, mm-hmm. those two worked together.
Very
and then there was
so.
The love song, and then uh-huh. there's some fun stuff. Bat Dance, it was just, like, a perfect climax to all that where it's, like, It sampled stuff from the movie. It sampled the, like, other earlier songs.
Right.
Like, I just thought
it was.
I thought it was well paced. I thought it was the right length of a soundtrack. I thought that I don't know. I just thought it was a better standalone album than AC/DC. Because AC/DC, like, if you gave me one of their CDs, I could say this one stands up better than that.
Right.
But Who Made Who would not be the one I picked.
So what about the last category, which was creative inspiration?
Okay, so definitely Batman on this one, right? Okay, because
right.
We'll talk about for just a little bit why AC/DC didn't do a good job, and then we'll talk a lot about why Prince did an awesome job.
Okay.
So AC/DC, I think they might have written Who Made Who for this.
We don't know for sure.
I
kind of said that earlier, but then I kind of thought, well, did they write it for us, or does it just...
Just a little bit of time telling you guys about some songs that Stephen King should have picked if one... Like, even if he's coked out of his mind, like, you recognize that Sink the Pink is not that good of a song. And, like, for those about to rock, you know, there's so many better Mission songs. And, like, there was a... I think there was a romance in this movie. Emilio Estevez and that, like, very thin girl.
And the truck. Yeah, the Green Goblin truck. Yeah, he was in love with it, I think.
Yeah. And so, like, there's clearly going to be, like, a love scene. And, like, AC/DC is... lousy with no that's the wrong term what you know lousy with means like they have a lot
uh-huh.
but after I said out loud it sounds like they're bad at
they are not lousy
no they have so many good love songs and you know like power ballad love songs mm-hmm. so it's like Shook Me All Night Long or mm-hmm. you know Walk All Over Me, Beating Around the Bush, they have so many good ones. They didn't use any of them
mm-hmm.
and then whenever they use Sink the Pink, which isn't that good of a song, they just like sort of threw it in there. And you're like, oh, you're just, I don't know, Highway to Hell. It's a song about a highway. They used Hell's Bells. Like, mm-hmm. it's like somebody, they put all the songs in a big bowl and they just picked them out.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. It was very frustrating to me that they didn't, you know, they could have done Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap when they're crawling through the sewer, because that's funny. You know, if you want blood, then you got it. That's just a good song. TNT, Livewire, mm-hmm. anything with, like, electricity. There's like 12 songs by AC/DC about electricity. I mean, they got a goddamn thunderbolt in their name. They didn't use any of them. You know,
yeah.
It's like electronics, nothing.
It was a disappointing thing, and they have at their disposal several classic.
Just because if they picked these songs, I assumed that they had access to all of them.
Sure.
Right? Because it's a major studio, and they wrote, I think they wrote Who Made Who for it.
Yeah, and I think they were very flattered by the fact that Stephen King was such a big fan of theirs.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that they would have given him, you know, access to any tracks that yeah. he wanted. But it just seemed like, to me, it just seemed like the album was kind of, oh, we need music for this album. Well, I like AC/DC. Let's you know, grab some tracks of theirs. And whether or not Who Made Who was written for the movie or not, I mean, it works. Right. The concept works, but it wasn't written with the film in mind, like the Batman soundtrack was. Despite the fact that three of those songs came before the album was written, Electric Chair really works with the not only the flow of where it appears on track two, but mm-hmm. also when we've kind of showed you the future. Mm-hmm. This is, and I believe that song plays on the radio right before the family's mugged right at the beginning.
Okay,
and they're kind of showing you this is the future of Gotham City.
You can't understand. I say too tough. It's just that I've seen the future. Boy, it's rough.
This is what we're heading to, Batman has to stop it.
And there's like the prostitute who hits on the young boy, and it's just like there's like open crime going on.
Right, this is the road we're going. You could tell that Prince understood what Tim Burton's vision of this movie was going to be, and he changed during that time. He started wearing darker clothes.
Right.
He pressed
his hair.
Yeah,
straightened his hair.
Right, he kind of saw that dark turn that they wanted to take Batman with, and he kind of started taking that meshed very well with what he wanted to do or what he needed to do to get back into the limelight and get back to doing what he did very well. And some of the songs, you hear little snippets of the movie put into them.
I really liked that. And that, for some reason, I enjoy that when that's in a soundtrack.
Yeah, I liked it too. I don't think you had to have that in order for it to work.
Right.
The songs were written in such a way that even if you didn't have that, they still would have worked well with the movie and the plot and the tone and everything, and how the movie progressed and how the soundtrack progressed kind of at the same pace. But the fact that they were kind of thrown in there, I don't think that they were thrown in there just to remind you that, hey, this is a Batman soundtrack. Right. If you had seen the movie, if you had listened to the soundtrack, they mesh together really well when you might not have thought originally that they would.
Right.
You know, like I said that earlier, that was the original thought that, we got to get Prince because Prince is so different.
Right.
And he will bring some light to this darkness because everybody likes the goofy, campy, light Batman. That's what everybody
is
That was actually getting a lot of play on reruns at the time.
Oh,
when
interesting.
That's kind of when it it went away for a while. The show was only on for a few years, but it went away for a while and then kind of came back in the 80s and started to get more play. And that was kind of everybody's interpretation of Batman. But, you know, Burton wanted to go a different way, and I thought Prince did a really good job of writing the tracks and arranging them and producing them in such a way that it really, you could tell that he was inspired by Burton's vision of the film.
Yeah, that's definitely a clear winner. I want to talk a little bit more about the sampling. I thought they did a good job where they incorporated in a way that wasn't over the top, wasn't obnoxious. It sort of like enhanced the actual song because it was telling its own story. You could see the arc of the film in the actual soundtrack, too. I thought that was... I don't think that's an easy thing to do. Mm-hmm. And I thought they did a really... Prince and whoever helped him, like, arrange the order of that stuff. I thought they did a really good job with definitely enhanced the listening experience because I'm like, I remember hearing that in the movie. And it's like, it brings you back to the scene. I just enjoyed that. I thought it was fun.
And we always, on our last podcast, before we picked a winner, we talked about our favorite and least favorite tracks on both.
Yeah.
Do you want to do that?
Sure.
So, Maximum Overdrive, what was your favorite track?
Hell's Bells.
Me too.
Cool. Oh, me too. That's fine.
It's just an amazing song in general. It's just from the start of the song, it takes the slowest musical medley that you can get, which is bells.
Boom.
You know, like a bells. It takes that's the slowest, musical thing that you can think of, and then it goes into a little bit quicker guitar riff, and then it picks up, and then, you know, Brian Johnson coming in saying, "I'm rolling thunder, pouring rain."
Right.
It just, you know, explodes from there.
Amazing.
And it's just fantastic.
Right.
So I agree with you on that one. That that was my favorite song on that album as well. What about your least favorite?
It's Shake Your Foundations isn't that great, but but the OEOEO saved it for me, so I'm going to go with Sync the Pink. Okay. I even like the instrumentals better than that.
I had a hard time picking that, too, and mine actually came down to those two.
That's fair.
As well.
DT or Chase the Ace?
Well, no, the two that you mentioned.
Oh, no way!
Sync the Pink and Shake Your Foundation.
That's cool.
And I had a hard time choosing. I mean, neither one is horrible.
For some reason, it seemed like there was a couple albums where Brian Johnson was either really nervous or whoever was mixing the songs didn't know how to do his vocals correctly.
Right, right. I picked Shake Your Foundations.
That's fair.
And I heard that when I was reading up on that, there was so much complaints that he couldn't hear what he was saying. So they remixed it and it was easier to listen to by the time it was re-released on the Who Made Who album. But to me, that kind of just sounded too much like generic AC/DC,
yeah,
but just not done as well.
Yeah,
there's nothing wrong with generic AC/DC. Generic just AC/DC sort of, is very good,
but it's,
you know, Brian Johnson's got such a unique voice that has served him well and served the band well over the years. But in that song, it kind of came off a little too screechy. I don't want to use a Randy Jackson American Idol pitchy,
too pitchy, bro,
too pitchy, dog. But that's the same two that you were, you know, deciding in between were the same too, and I just went with Shake Your Foundations.
That's pretty cool.
So what about Batman?
I'm going to tell you my least favorite first.
Okay.
Because I got to really think about which one was my favorite. Least favorite was Arms of Orion. It just didn't do it for me because I didn't like the way they did the romance in Batman, and this song seemed to fit with an actual romance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that because those were so disconnected, that hearing the song, I'm like, I don't like it. Like, it doesn't fit. It didn't work for me.
The romance aspect of the Batman movie is one of the weaker components of it, I think. My least favorite song was the one that actually had probably the most well-known on there, which was Bat Dance.
Okay.
The reason I haven't spoken to Prince personally about this, but I kind of have a feeling probably the least proud of that one on the album.
What about the part where it says it's all sound bites? It's
Sticky Veil. Sticky Veil. I like Batman.
That's why I hated it.
Yes.
And then Michael Keaton goes,
she is great, isn't she?
And then, I don't know.
And then Michael Keaton responds back, I'd like to. That's why I didn't like it. It was kind of a fun song, but it
sounds
comes
like
off,
a soundboard.
It comes off corny.
It comes off overproduced.
Like I said, it was the most well-known song on the album. It was the most well-promoted. And I even remember the video where Prince was dressed half as the Joker and crazily cool, but the fact that that was the song that accompanied it, not that it's unlistenable. I was actually listening to it. Sirius XM's doing a tribute station to Prince right now on The Groove, and it's only for a week, and that was actually playing when I got into the car.
Cool.
But that was the one that I was least happy with.
Yeah. I think my favorite song would be The Future.
Yeah, that was mine too.
And so I also liked Lemon Crush.
Uh-huh.
But when you listen to The Future, I go back to this thing a lot where it's like you can tell when a song was made most of the time. Really good stuff from like the 70s and 80s rings out as timeless. Like you can listen to a Led Zeppelin song and you're like, you know what? I can't tell when that originated. Like, you know, good Rolling Stones or like good Beatles stuff. Like that's a timeless thing. Like I thought that one, it did a really good job of the way he does his vocals was interesting. Especially because it was like the first track too. I thought that was a perfect way to start off.
Yeah, and some of the lines in there, you know, they talk about, I love the line that says, Yellow Smiley offers me X, like he's drinking 7-Up. I would rather drink 6 razor blades,
from a paper cup. Yeah, it was awesome.
It was
whoa, that's real dark.
You know, Prince was never, you know, big into the drug scene or anything
Pretty straight edge.
And that kind of, you know, anti-drug statement made in a cool, funky way.
Right.
But it also, it harkens to, you know, where Gotham is at the time. There was, you know, several messages, I think, in that song. Right. I really thought it was just a very good song. And it's kind of sad that a couple that I thought were excellent. And some of the songs that I go back to when I listen to Prince, that, you know, those are some of the first songs that pop up into my head will never be able to be on these compilations. Right. And maybe that'll change. Yeah. You know, maybe the...
Because it's been...
And especially now that it's, you know, it would be, you know, posthumously, you know, Warner Brothers will kind of have a change of heart in there. But we talked about Future and Electric Chair back to back.
Yeah.
Just, you really know, strong. Just an awesome, you know, 1-2 punch.
Right.
For the album. And Party Man is a very good song, and I don't know if that's more less of a good song and more the fact that it's tied into that
right.
scene,
right? And it's, if it that's touches what, if that the character enhances, so well,
if that would it, I don't know if it would work as well in isolation,
right?
But, there's just, you know, so many good songs. And you were talking about Lemon Crush.
Yeah.
That was actually when we were talking about Anna Fantastic earlier. That was the name of her favorite drink.
No, oh, like Orange Crush, yeah. Lemon Crush. That's
and
awesome.
And that was fun. The name of her favorite drink, and that's why he... Fun facts for No One Tell there.
Okay. Look at the score. Prince's single artist soundtrack for the Batman 1989 movie is our clear winner.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't go into this thinking that, and we're not doing it just because he passed away recently. Right. But, I mean, if you were listening...
We tried to break it down, you know, right. piece by piece, and I think we did a pretty good job of that.
Yeah. So we are at the last part of our podcast, second to last part of our podcast, where we give recommendations for what we thought would be the best single artist soundtrack. So,
or just something that falls into that criteria that you should listen to that
right.
that you would like.
So, do you want to go first?
Or
you
sure.
Want to go first?
Okay. I picked what I feel is a very good single artist soundtrack, and that was the soundtrack to Superfly by Curtis Mayfield.
Nice. All right.
If you have not heard it, you're missing out on not only a great album, a great soundtrack, but also it's actually seen as one of for that time period in the, you know, late 60s, early 70s, it's seen as up there, you know, even with Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, as
wow.
far as like so. And I am going to hate you forever if while I'm talking about this, I don't, when this is edited and put back together, I don't hear
Tell
the,
me what,
the song in the background.
Give me a song that
either,
I should play in
either
the background.
Either Superfly or Freddy's Dead.
Oh.
I want to hear
right.
one of those in the background.
Okay.
And if it's not there, then I want people to tweet out vile things at Mike.
That seems fair.
But it's just a classic soul funk album. And it was a soundtrack that actually was so popular that it outgrossed the film,
wow.
Money wise.
I guess that's not good for the film, right?
No, not good for the film. But you know, there are we talked about the, you know, possibly doing a show on that, on soundtracks, you know,
that'd be fun.
That outgrossed the films because there are several out there. But it's just the topics that are discussed in there, you know, about, you know, poverty and drug abuse and things like that that were going on, especially in, you know, the hardships faced by the African-American community during that time. But he presents it in such a way that it's just very soulful. It's just a great album, and I think it falls into our criteria of the entire album being done by, or the entire soundtrack being done by one artist, and I think everybody should give it a listen.
Awesome. And with that rendition, or the information you provided, where it was like social commentary,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, clearly mine beats yours because it's the Iron Man 2 soundtrack, which is all AC/DC again.
Mm-hmm.
And this time it's like Jon Favreau seems to actually be an AC/DC fan,
uh-huh.
and he also knows what his movie is about.
Uh-huh.
So he, fun fact, he uses Black Ice. I brought that up again, the Walmart exclusive
uh-huh.
album, because there's a song called War Machine, and you're like, oh, that's War Machine's in Iron Man 2, right? You're like, yeah. And so that
makes
was
sense.
There that was the, if you remember the trailer, they were playing Shoot to Thrill,
uh-huh.
and I've had people who, because they know I'm an AC/DC fan, they're like, you know what, I started listening to them because of Iron Man 2 soundtrack. And I said, oh my god, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'd seen the movie, I did not know that they did the whole album. And so
mm-hmm.
I looked what I would do if I were a director and made a film. I would just make, I would pick these songs. Like, these were the songs where I would have sent a letter through time to Stephen King and been like, hey man, just take a look at this. This is, you're missing out. Like, they have all the songs I mentioned and like some of my favorite songs that were never like singles or never made it,
mm-hmm.
you know, to radio play, that I'm just like, this is why I like AC/DC, because, you know, they're fun, they're like frenetic, they're creative and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And like Iron Man 2 definitely was enhanced by like rock music, because, you know, that's exactly what the character would listen to when he's like in his suit, you know, flying right. around and stuff.
I think, I mean, just the Tony Stark character in general,
the attitude.
He is a rock star of his, you know, of his part of the world.
Right.
I mean, he doesn't, you know, function like, you know, most billionaire, that billionaires that made their money off of tech. You
right.
know, he's not a Steve Jobs kind of guy. He is, you know, in your face, you know, cocky rock star. He is too. And, you know, you talk about Shoot to Thrill. You mm-hmm. know, when I hear that song now, and I think they even used it in the Avengers movie.
Oh, cool.
When Iron Man first pops up there, he kind of comes in and Shoot the Thrill. And I'm just thinking, oh, this just works perfectly with, you know, with who he is and the tone of his character.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, like War Machine, mm-hmm. you know, Have a Drink on Me. Right. That's, I mean, that's Tony Stark.
Yeah.
But just, If You Want Blood, You've Got It. I just, I love
such a good song.
That song.
Yeah.
I guess the first time I heard that was Empire Records.
Mm-hmm.
That scene where he's, you know, playing the drums to that song, and they pump it out through the whole store.
Yeah, it's awesome.
But I mean, that it comes off, that soundtrack comes off as a, you know, almost like a just a very good best of AC/DC, but also, you know, tying into the movie well, which is what Maximum Overdrive could have done, but didn't.
Because this is sort of the example where all the songs were already created,
mm-hmm.
like some of them, you know. Rock and Roll Damnation, Cold Hearted Man, those are like off of one of their first albums, mm-hmm. like 78, and then Let There Be Rock, 77. Like, that's crazy that mm-hmm. you would find music, like, you would look that hard off of all the... Because they have a pretty good catalog of songs, and you're just like, you're not going to have anybody write music for Iron Man, because that would be awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what... I mean, the first album had some of that, where... There's one of the members of the Wu-Tang Clan called Tony Starks. And he has a song about, like, Iron Man. And it's awesome. And I think the first one did a good job of that. And the second one just stepped it up because, you know, that's just where... I think they had their head in the right space for the movie. It fits with the movie. And I think that's something that...
And you can't just
difficult
put,
to catch.
You can't just put Black Sabbath, Iron Man on every album and and call it a day.
I mean, you'd have to throw some War Pigs in there.
I like how they, you know, you got to have that on the first one,
but
for the
fun.
Second one,
yeah.
they went kind of different and
yeah.
just said, you know, what else would go with the tone of this movie? And I, AC/DC just works perfectly with that.
Awesome. All right, now for a couple of plugs. Dan, what do you got going on?
Basically, our MMA podcast that I do with Dane McGuire, Punch Drunk Radio, is starting to pick up some steam.
Excellent.
We're starting to get some more sponsors, and we're getting picked up by more websites.
Wow, cool.
In addition to Inside STL, which was where we started here in St. Louis, we got picked up by HalfGuarded.com, which is... a offshoot of the Wrestling Observer, which is a website and a newsletter for pro wrestling that's been around for a long time. So we're really excited about that.
That's awesome.
So it's going to be on iTunes very soon. Right now, all the episodes are up on YouTube. Just search Punch Drunk Radio or search my name. You can check me out on Twitter at Dan Rino, DanRyno. And I always post any new articles I write for pro wrestling or MMA on there. And hopefully get to come back and do this with you again very soon.
Yeah, all right. Thanks. Thanks for listening to episode number 3 of the podcast, and I hope you enjoyed it. Look us up on Tumblr. We are comparing apples to oranges, all one word, .tumblr.com. That's where all of the links for my co-hosts and info about upcoming and past episodes will be. Any comments or ideas for future podcasts, please send it to our Twitter is Cato Podcast, all one word. Or you can email us at catopodcast@gmail.com. Our intro and outro music, as well as some of the music beds, was Thumbs Up by a great artist named Leisure B. If you liked his stuff and want to check out more, go to humanworkshop.com. Thanks for listening. Bye.